CliffCentral.com.
Good morning, everybody. It is the time of the week where we check in on the Burning Platform, our opportunity to get into all the big stories. And this is a story that's been going on. Pumi's holding up the book. It's a story that's been going on in South African popular culture. And I think people have been obsessed with it for various reasons. But no doubt anybody who was already knows that there's a book out, and very, very smart footwork by the guys at Ground Up. And we're going to meet them in just a second, in particular the two authors of the Thabo Bester story, which they launched in Johannesburg last night, and they are on our show this morning. I'm delighted to have them in the studio this morning. Let me just remind you, the Thabo Bester story, the Facebook rapist, the celebrity doctor, and the escape from cell 35. It is the quintessential crime story in South Africa. We've got murder, we've got rape, we've got cons, a love affair.
Glitzy events in Joburg.
Yeah.
Politicians and celebrities.
Absolutely. All the stuff you could possibly want here. And the two journalists are in the studio with us this morning. Let's welcome them to the show this morning. Marisha Damons, how are you? Hang on, let me switch on your mic. There we go. Start again.
I'm doing really well. Thank you so much for having us.
Good. I'm so pleased we could have you, and I'm so pleased that we didn't have to cancel your appearance this morning because of power. How did the launch go last night?
It went quite well. Some of the questions we were asked, I think, really made us think a bit more in terms of what sort of impact we wanted the book to have. And it was just interesting to see that the attendees were not too focused on the sensational element of the story as a whole.
Well, it's a sensational story. So we may be disappointing to you this morning on that front. And I also want to welcome Daniel Steyn. It's very nice to have you here too. And congratulations on the book to you as well.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah. All right. So how did it go for you last night? Did you also, were you disappointed by the people or happy that they asked sensible questions?
No, I really enjoyed it. It was also good having some people we didn't know, people who had read the book, people who were buying the book to read. And that was great, hearing why they're interested in the story. And
this story only broke a little while ago, and you guys have been on the move ever since. I mean, you must have been in court. You must have been reading every day. I mean, Pumi and I have tried to keep up with it since it started, and I don't know if we've even done a good job. Listen, so I'm very impressed with what you've done.
I am sending this book right after the show to my aunt who's in Washington, who is obsessed with this story. Because she's in Washington and she's so many hours behind us, she and I have to have like a little catch up at the beginning of every day because the court case is now starting, but also because this is mind-blowing how unbelievable all of the components of this story have been. So I do think, first, you have to take us back to the beginning of why you were interested in the story to begin with.
And why South Africa?
And that newsroom session, that diary session that said, yeah, we're going to follow the story.
So it started in October last year when my editor, Nathan Geffen, just pulled me aside and he said that he had the story that he wanted me to cover. But it was very bizarre and the details of it were completely confidential. And we actually ended up having to meet in a separate office because the details were confidential. And we got there and he told me that he received a tip-off from Justice Cameron telling him that the investigations into the Facebook rapist's death had been taking quite long. But when I got into the office, he first asked me if I remembered the Facebook rapist, and I told him no, because in Bester's heydays of his crimes, I mean, I was...
You were young!
I was young.
The mics have gone off. I can't hear. What's happening?
They're not working? Hang on a second. No, just keep talking.
Keep talking?
Yeah, I was...
No, you're fine.
Okay. I was still quite young in the heydays of Bester's crimes. I mean, I was in primary school and then starting out in high school, so I was definitely not following the news. And Nathan just gave me a bit of a rundown saying that he was called the Facebook rapist because he used Facebook to lure these aspiring models, and they would agree to meet up. And when they met up, he would rob them, he would rape them, sometimes he would stab them, and he murdered at least one of his victims. And earlier that year, which would have been in May last year, a fire had broken out in his cell and he died. And I remember sitting there thinking, okay, well,
he died.
He died. What is the story here? And Nathan just said that there were rumors that Bester had escaped and that he was helped by a prison official who was nicknamed Snowy. And my eyes just went so much wider. And I think as soon as Nathan saw that, he immediately shut it down and said, look, we need to focus on the facts. These are just rumors, okay? So my first point of call was just to get an update on where things were standing with the investigation. Had they identified the body yet? So we were not investigating Bester's escape, but just that the investigations into his supposed death at the time was just really, really dragging. So I wasn't even that interested in the story at the time, just because it seemed so mundane and it was about a rapist and murderer who was burned to death.
Talking about boards, so coincidentally, it's a board member that brought the story to you. So how did you get in?
Right. So I think the thinking behind Marisha's early inquiries was that just by asking questions, so, you know, Edwin Cameron, Justice Edwin Cameron, is a board member of Ground Up and has a friendship with our editor. So he told Nathan about these rumors, and that's what prompted us to start asking questions. And the thinking was that by asking questions and writing an article saying that there are questions, we would be pressuring the government to be transparent. And they stopped responding to media inquiries about this. In January, Justice Cameron then leaked Marisha and Nathan the judge's report. Two judges had gone to the prison, interviewed people, and the rumors then again surfaced. And in that, we found out that the body was dead before the fire broke out. So that was the first time that we realized that that this body did not die from the fire in the cell, right? So whatever Justice Cameron had told Nathan off the record was not available to us to publish. And Nathan also guarded then what information he gave to us. And then throughout, so by February this year, we realized that it's going to be our job to break the story. The government's not going to pick up on the signal we're trying to send, which is come clean. And when we realized that, then we had several leads. A prison warden had reached out to us from Marisha's early articles. Dr. Magudamana's brother had contacted us. It took us a while before we believed that he was actually her brother. We learned about the court case that she had brought shortly after the fire where she tried to claim Thabo Bester's body. And so all of that information led to 5 or 6 weeks of very intensive investigation. And then on the 15th of March, we were able to break the story.
So let's just go back to where these two characters entered the national conversation, because it staggers me even to this day that we didn't know much about this. I mean, I'm now subsequent to that met people who said, oh, Dr. Nandipa is wonderful. I met her a couple of times and she's superb and I can't believe she's embroiled in this saga. And we didn't know who Thabo Bester was before. We didn't even know why he was in jail. And then we discover afterwards he's like this criminal mastermind. There have been all kinds of suspicious things happening long before with these two. Is South Africa such a Wild West scenario that you could just do these crazy things and most of the time fly under the radar? Isn't that disturbing?
I think one of the things that aided Thabo Bester to fly under the radar is the fact that he technically didn't exist on the system because he didn't have an ID number, which I find quite odd, seeing that he was behind bars for more than a decade, and surely someone should have flagged that this man doesn't have an identity. But I think the culture that we have of sort of placing celebrities and people with wealth on a pedestal might have actually added to how Bester and Magudumana were able to get away with so much for so long, because she, you know, seems like this respectable character. I mean, she was a wife, a mother. She had her own aesthetics practice. Mm. She has this rags to riches type of story. So I think a lot of people could identify with that. And she was also very vocal for gender-based violence, women abuse. And people looked up to her as this figure. And I mean, to a certain extent, she was some sort of an influencer, if I could call her that. I mean,
social media. She definitely had a social media presence that allowed her in the beauty segment. But then an interesting kind of fate or luck also played a big role in kind of getting this story, because Ground Up does a lot of really interesting articles, really interesting stories that are outside of the spectrum of what a lot of the
proper
media
investigative
houses,
journalism. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of what the media houses are doing. But this kind of catapulted you because of this one really insignificant, it seemed at the time. Again, Facebook post.
Yeah, so Ground Up is a non-profit organization, and it's about 10 or 11 years old. And yeah, our bread and butter is stories about service delivery. Basically, we look at the rights enshrined in the Constitution and then write stories about what those rights look like in South Africa and where people are not able to access those rights. So that's kind of the broad mandate of Ground Up. We don't go chasing celebrity stories, right? And it's because of that mandate, and I think because we've grown a team over the past 10 years, I'm a new member of Ground Up. Marisha's been around for, what, 2 years?
Yeah, about 2 years.
But, you know, we've built a bit of a reputation. During COVID, for example, we built quite a reputation of doing kind of reliable reporting on COVID. And obviously Justice Cameron felt that we were a trusted organization to then take this information to. So this would be, you know, in-depth investigation isn't necessarily our mandate. Like Amma Bungane, for example, that does a lot of forensic investigation. Although we think all journalism is investigative to some degree. So what interested our editors and kind of informed how we report the story was, where did the system fail? Where did the investigations fail, take long? Why is it taking so long? And also questions about privatization of prisons. What our prisons look like.
Yeah, because these are things that are going on at the same time that no one's really paying attention
exactly.
to.
Yeah.
So government's role in all of this, because that's what I find kind of perplexing, is that on one hand, they seem very laissez-faire about everything. Oh, well, you know, the prisons are what the prisons are. What do you want us to do about it? These are bad people who get put in these horrible places, and life just gets more horrible for them. For society as a whole, everything's a disaster. But then there's also this part of like, well, we're in charge here and we know what's going on and we actually can get to the bottom of this. And clearly they couldn't. I remember those hearings where Glynis Breitenbach, among others, was asking some very, very tough and uncomfortable questions. Suddenly we're shown the really ugly face of prisons, which is that it's a money-making scheme and that there are huge interests, and I mean nefarious interests, when it comes to how prisons are run and who's actually in charge there and who's been giving tenders and how this doesn't improve society or the lives of prisoners or the safety and security of people within those prisons, the wardens, the, you know, the whole infrastructure, the hierarchy, the service providers. And then these people come out on the other side much worse than they went in.
I think if we, with the G4A specifically, if we look at the history of private prisons in the country. So in the late 90s, there was this shortage of prisons in South Africa, and government felt that the solution was to build more prisons. And they entered into this agreement with Bloemfontein Correctional Contracts in 2000 to build a maximum security prison in Bloemfontein. And there were multiple shareholders, of which G4S was one of them. There were also three BEE companies that were also shareholders. And one of these companies was a community trust that was mandated to start projects that were supposed to uplift the Bloemfontein community. I'm not sure how far they came with that.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Exactly.
There was one budget presented to Parliament in 2004 of how they're going to use the profits, their share of the profits to do education projects, health projects, business development. And since then, there's been no oversight. And in fact, two of these BEE companies have the same director, who is a former mayor of Mangaung. And his brother is the director of one of the companies, who was a former board member of Bidvest. So you've got this conflict of interest, the business interest in this purely private prison. And then even, I mean, there's only two private prisons in South Africa. The rest are government-run. But even in the government-run prisons, you obviously have tenders.
Yeah.
And there are people
twisted
like...
and crooked.
Yeah, there are people like the Integricon Security Solutions, whose CCTV operators currently facing charges, who have contracts in public prisons, SA Fence and Gate, where there's big corruption and links to dodgy characters. Like
Thabo Bester and Dr. Madung, what I can never
pronounce.
I can't even say it this morning. I could say it earlier, but now
you can say just Dr. Nandipa.
Thank you very much.
Especially because she is married to Makudumane. Yes. Is her married
shame.
Name?
I mean, he
and she's married to somebody she went to medical school with. So there are actually two Dr. Makudumanas. And so Dr. Nandipa will suffice.
Yeah, Dr. Nandipa. Anyway, these two aside, you've uncovered all this other extra information, which has led to people suddenly questioning stuff that they thought was outside of the story. I mean, you know, we kind of put prisoners away and we forget about them. It's a bit sad, actually. All right, so let's just move on from there, because the case itself has become very, very interesting, and you've got social media all ablaze with every small detail
every
of their
detail.
Body language and what's going on behind the scenes and the love affair and all of this stuff. It's hard not to get distracted by this stuff when you're also trying to tell the actual story, and you guys are journalists. So where do you draw the line there, and how do you not get pulled into the clickbait stuff that so many other news outlets seem to be reporting on?
I think, firstly, our main focus with the court reporting was to just report on the facts and just some of the updates. But of course, we can't completely ignore the sensational elements of the story. More specifically, when we would cover court cases, the accused don't show up, you know, dressed to the nines. And in this instance here, we have Dr. Nandipa showing up with her edges laid and a new hairstyle, and her nails were done.
And you wonder how that happens when you're in custody.
and Bester showing up in what appears to be expensive attire. So we did have some discussions at Grindup about, do we include these elements or do we solely focus on the court case? And at times we would at most add a sentence about what they were wearing. But we never wanted that to be the sole focus of our court reporting.
I also think they're putting on a show, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in court. And they thrive on the social media buzz, even if it's negative press. So we don't necessarily want to feed that, but we want to report on the court process. And I think our approach going forward with this is going to be making sure, reporting on where maybe the court process is being delayed, the legalistic aspect.
So that was the thing that stood out to me about the book, was exactly that. The fact that it doesn't have any of the salacious stuff. You know, it really is, it's a serious look at where some of the failings are, but also at the entire story around it. And I'm wondering how you find the balance, because it's so easy to not even know where that information has come from, because it's everywhere all the time, and picking those things apart. How do you, in the newsroom, make sure that those things don't filter back into the writing?
I think one of the most helpful elements are our editorial team, and how they have guided us into what we should focus on and what we perhaps shouldn't include. With the court reporting, I think with the story as a whole, at Grindup, there is a certain style of reporting that we focus on, and it generally does not include salacious elements. But once again, we can't completely
ignore it.
Exactly. The salacious and sensational element of it, because I think that adds to the bizarre element of the story. So it was definitely the support of the editors, I believe, to just sort of refine our writing. And even with the book, the editorial team once again, because I know with our first couple of drafts, we were very forensic, I think, focusing on the technical elements. But the editorial team was saying, hey,
if you want to sell books, you have to put some more of that salacious stuff
in. The book is obviously not a ground up project in and of itself. So that we were able in the book to go a bit beyond Ground Up's mandate, and to also to explore aspects that fascinated us. You know, Nandipa's childhood, Thabo Bester's childhood. So there's interviews with Bester's mom, with
tell us without giving away any of the things that you want people to go and buy the book and read for themselves. There have to be some things that you've even discovered in doing the backstories and all the rest that have blown your mind and that help color in those things that are missing for so many people. Because these two do seem like they're almost fictional characters in some ways. So when you actually find out, no, these are real people, this is how they grew up, this is why they're the way they are, this is the kind of lifestyle that they had together and separately before the story broke. That's interesting, right? Give us some little nuggets.
A hint. This is your ad break.
Yeah, this is where you get to. This is where you get to promote the book by telling us, "Here's what I'll give you in there, and there's more." Right?
Yeah. So with Thabo Bester's childhood, you know, we look into basically the picture that it paints is from a very early age he was involved in crime and scamming people, and how this has been a key part of his personality since he was like 4 years old, at least.
Wow.
And we go into his crimes. Marisha did a great interview with one of his scam victims before he went to prison. Mm-hmm. And I think what we also do is, because there's so many myths around Thabo Bester and rumors, and some news reports, even from 2010, 2011, get some stories wrong, that what we try to do is to verify as much as possible and to point out where we can't verify. And then with Magudumana's story, the same thing where, I mean, like Marisha mentioned, the rags to riches story, going back into her family history, how her parents got married in a township in Durban, moved to Bizana and at the point of transition to democracy, where they benefited from a political transition. They were the first black family to own a house in Port Edward. And the racism they experienced at school, and how Magudumana had to overcome all odds to become the celebrated doctor that she became. And I think that also goes to the tragic story of Magudumana, the rise and fall of
Nandini. Yeah, people love
and
this.
Her father being like
and then
in
being
August.
Involved. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, and then there's obviously also the story of the guy who was the body, the guy who was sacrificed here so that it could look like Thabo Bester had escaped prison. And his poor family had who've been looking for him for years, and then eventually found out that he was this stand-in. Mm. I mean, it's a terrible, sad story. It also shows you how some people's lives are just completely without value in our system. Mm.
Absolutely. I think that was possibly the most tragic element of the story for Daniel and myself, because we were not there when Bester was this headlining convict in 2011. So the most recent element of his crimes would be what ended up happening to Katlego Bereng. Mm. I mean, his family described him as this loving, kind individual. He was unemployed at the time, but he was there for his children. And we know that South Africa is a rather fatherless society. And here you have a young man in his 30s who went out of his way to be there for his two kids. He was a great father. And just thinking of the conflicting stories that the family had received about what actually happened to him and how he ended up dying. I mean, there were multiple versions of him collapsing in the street and hitting his head, and another one saying that he died along the way to the hospital. Another version was that he died at the hospital. But it's so unfortunate that someone of Katlego's nature and character would end up being used as the decoy body in a maximum security prison.
And also what happens to a poor black man who collapses in town, is taken by ambulance to the hospital where he dies, and how his body is then treated, right? He sits among hundreds of bodies in a morgue.
Unidentified.
And even though he was declared missing by his family a year prior, a year prior to us now
finding
out who he was, then being handed over to the next person who comes and says that it's his body. And that cuts to and then how Magudumana and Bester were able to exploit that system, which cuts to the core of kind of class problems in South Africa.
But also, it's just amazing that you can get a body into a prison.
Yes, yeah.
Fake this person's death, create a fire, and there's just such surface investigation in inverted commas, which is clearly a cover-up. You need insiders.
Yeah.
All of this is just so corrupt.
But there is also an element of the story around the life that Dr. Nandipa and Thabo then lived when he got out of prison, you know, with the high-end lifestyle that they were living, the house in Hyde Park.
These people who work for them.
The people around them.
The
listen, the people who work for them and the one who ends up dead in the backyard.
In the backyard.
Yeah.
Do you just color in some of that part of the story and in your coverage and your reporting, how that part also ties into the story?
I think if we go back to that now notorious Woolworths photo, I think that that firstly just speaks to how Bester had believed that he had gotten away with this escape, because one would think that after escaping prison or faking your death, you'd maybe want to keep a low profile. But a mere month after his supposed death, there he was, you know, out in the open. Even looking at the scam property company that they were running, Aram, seeing that the focus of that property company was for it to be these high-end properties aimed at, once again, the upper class of society, and how they try to portray this image of wealth. I think that that also just speaks to the culture of how society views wealth, and that seems to be something that you need to attain by all means necessary.
It's prevalent everywhere, not just in prisons and in criminals. I mean, you see people doing this. You're supposedly legitimate business people in South Africa who are using conspicuous consumption and spending to give themselves a sense of value. It's very, very sad. It's actually a terrible indictment on our society.
You know, the part of this entire story that still kind of boggles my mind is the translation of all the on paper scam to actual physical cash in bags on a plane. In a foreign country. That also, for me, is a little bit of part of an uncovering of the murky world that the South African underbelly has, right? Because how they get to, no matter how much of a social media influencer you are, the lifestyle does not correspond to the amount of money that were being spent, or even the money that they had physically in
where
cash on them
from,
when they were arrested. Yeah. How does that happen? Yeah, how do they translate that into cash money, really? Yeah.
Well, we know that Thabo Bester had an ability to present as someone that he's not. There's reports that before he went to prison, he chartered a plane, giving a fake proof of payment, and then still being able to get on the plane with his guests. So I think there's a big level of pretense and being able to present as bigger than he is and richer than he is. And so I think maybe, that would be a lot of it, is kind of creating the facade of wealth where there isn't real wealth. And also being an erratic spender. So he runs these scams. He comes into a lot of money, cash money from selling tickets to a fake event the Aram properties, those are millions of rands, and there's fraud charges against Margo D'Amano's companies now, up to 50 million rands worth of people who pay deposits for houses to be built, luxury houses to be built in Joburg, and they believed the company because it was Margo D'Amano. How would you not believe this wonderful doctor and successful businesswoman? So that meant a lot of money came in. Those houses were never built. So it's not running a real business. We know running a business means
it's
money comes
scheme.
In and you can't just spend all the money on a Porsche, right? Or on going to.
Yeah.
And I actually think that there's less money involved than we think. Thabo Bester likes spreading rumors that he's a billionaire, which is completely false. And that list that he gave the magistrates court of all the watches and the cash, I think that's absolute nonsense.
If I can, I mean, you guys have won the 2023 Nat Mikasa Award for Media Integrity for your work on this particular story, but there are other stories that you've cracked in recent months. And one of the ones that, Daniel, I'd like to talk to you about is where political parties get their money. Because that, while we're on money, is a fascinating story. And I don't
and
think
the
most...
the murky underworld.
Again, I don't think most South Africans even have the slightest inclination as to who's funding the political parties. And that is important because these people have the ear of those politicians. So when it comes to creating laws or escaping laws or doing whatever they want in the private or public sector, if you are the one paying the political parties, guess who gets the first say and the biggest say in South Africa? And this is a very frightening idea. For most of us, we think, oh, well, it's political parties, votes, it's what they say on the campaign trail. That's not the case.
Yeah, so we know, obviously, that The richest parties are the ones who have the biggest campaign budgets.
Yeah.
And where influence comes from money. So there were there was a bill that now mandates that political parties disclose all donations above 100,000.
This is a law that's been passed.
The IEC once a quarter will publish what has been declared.
Yeah. So what have we found out since this law has come to pass?
So an organization called My Vote Counts, which is a great organization who's been advocating for this law, has developed this web tool, which is a story that you're referring to that I did a report on, that basically collates all this data and visualizes it, showing where different political parties are getting their money from. And the biggest takeaway, you've got the Oppenheimers, for example, funding the DA.
Mary Slack and her daughters.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But I think the biggest kind of headline there is the United Mangalese of the Kalahari, which is a front for a Russian oligarch and money that's going directly into the ANC's coffers. And I think that's the, when we think about
United
Lady R,
Mangalese of the Kalahari.
Yeah, it's a mining company.
I mean, they make steel in the Northern Cape.
Yeah.
And who is this Russian oligarch?
I can't remember his name now.
it's phenomenal to me. So these guys are responsible for 27% of the money that the ANC gets.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. So obviously when it comes to policy like Russia, Ukraine.
Yeah, exactly.
We cannot take the ANC seriously if 27% of their money comes from this Russian oligarch.
But it's also interesting when you look at that funding is how well spread everyone's risk is, right? So you give to the ANC, you must give to the DA, the EFF.
Yeah, so these people aren't even principled, these donors. Yeah. They basically are trying to cover the bases. Yeah. They're spreading their bets, so to speak.
Patrice Motsepe is a big
Patrice Motsepe is a big funder. I mean, I'm just looking at donation flows by donor groups on the side here. Yeah, there's some very interesting people here. The Oppenheimer family, Martin Moschel. We've got Patrice Motsepe. Other is a large category. But then there's also this United Mangalese of Kalahari. Mm. And the ANC gets the lion's share, followed by the DA. And then Action SA has quite a large piece of the pie. I see.
Yeah.
That's grown considerably. But the EFF don't seem to come up as a big recipient of donations. Is there a reason for that, or are we missing something?
That I can't comment on.
So, we just had such a short first hour, but one of the things that I had wanted to talk about was conspiracy theories, right? Which a lot of the stuff, when you start reading Ground Up, and I've been reading Ground Up articles for a very long time, they sound like conspiracies. When you first start reading the articles, it's like, no ways. That's the first, right? Sounds like conspiracies. And similarly, when you look at things like political party funding in South Africa and the story that very quickly went away a couple of weeks ago with the fake proof of payments for the EFF.
Yes.
Yeah. At AfriForum.
Yeah.
And how quickly that all went away. But underneath all of that, there really is a story, I think, that isn't being looked at thoroughly enough. Maybe because of money, maybe because the main big news owners have their own point of view of who they support in the space. And I'm interested to know how you decide in the newsroom, in the diary sessions at Ground Up, that this is too far-fetched a story to follow up, or are all stories up for discussion and maybe following up?
Mm. Well, normally when we do get multiple tip-offs, as bizarre as the story might seem, our first point of call is to firstly see, is this a Ground Up type of story, and is there a clear failure of the state? But secondly, it's whether this source has any proof to back up some of their claims. And it is mainly the editors who do have the final say as to whether we follow through on a story or not. And when we do follow through on it, we do try to maintain the integrity of the story and to not focus on elements that may very well be untrue. Articles also go through a very rigorous fact-checking process, either by our fellow colleagues or even by our editors, just to make sure that when the article is published, that this is a factually correct article. But I think that if we look at it from a broader issue, the media does tend to constantly be chasing the next headlining story. So if a story is hot and happening this week, then that is the focus for this week. And next week there might be something else. Then the media chases that story, and suddenly the initial story gets forgotten.
Sustain stories,
and of course, people also question the media, and rightly so, because they go, "Well, why are you guys interested in this story but not in others?" You know, and who's funding the media? Which is an interesting question too, because that can very much drive in which direction conversations go. Pumi is interested in what happens in the newsroom, but people won't talk about the fact that Open Society, for example, is involved in so many of our media publications here, and that they drive an agenda.
So we have a small, I don't think this year we were funded by Open Society, but we have historically been funded by Open Society to a small part of our budget. So at Ground Up, there's a clear line of separation between our donors and...
So they don't tell you what to do.
And the editorial.
And our editors are, I mean, Nathan is principled to a point of irritation for me sometimes. You know, so if we realize that a donor wants to push a certain agenda, we cut ties with them immediately. And we disclose all our donors on our board and on our website. And I think that's the point, is transparency. That's what breeds conspiracy theory, is a lack of transparency and the fact that things happen behind closed doors and are not disclosed. And we see that with the Tabu Bester story. Because there was so much kept behind,
in secret.
It's kept secret. That conspiracy theories. It's very difficult to debunk.
I think it's great that you acknowledge that, but the Open Society is probably one of the biggest donors, about 800,000 according to figures from December 2022. And I didn't bring you here to like nail you on this because they're funding lots of other people too.
Yeah, but it's 10% of our budget.
But it's important to know this stuff because otherwise people go, oh, well, you guys are also just pushing a narrative. Mm. And I don't mean in terms of the Tabu Bester story, which clearly is something that people are interested in. But when it comes to, you know, political party funding, they'll also scream and kick and complain. Why are Ground Up going after us and our donors? And the donors themselves will say, why are you guys making a big issue out of us funding political parties? Someone has to, and at least we're spending our money in a good way. It's difficult to figure out this stuff. All right, so... another question, and this is more about Nisfas and Bladen Zimande, because you've been doing a lot of work on this, Marisha. And I know you're already sighing and rolling your eyes. What is going on with higher education in this country? Because it seems to me like even this whole situation at the moment with UNISA being put under administration, and then they're fighting Bladen Zimande because they don't want to be put under administration. The losers at the end of this are the students, clearly. And it just seems that there's no one representing them. It's all about university administration, the Department of Higher Education, power struggles. The students are not even a factor in any of this, are they?
Yeah, so I wasn't even entirely aware of the NISFAS issue until earlier this year when some of those protests had started, and I actually got... a better understanding of things by speaking to the students who were saying that they hadn't received their allowances, meaning that they couldn't buy basic toiletries or food. And you need that in order to study. And also, if you haven't paid your fees, you can't access your results.
And then you can't register for the following year.
Exactly
it's
that.
It's got a knock-on effect.
Exactly that. And all of these issues seem to have started when NISFAS, for some reason, introduced these direct pay companies, because usually the agreement was just between universities, NISFAS, and then the students and, of course, their respective banks. But suddenly there were these direct pay companies that were brought into the picture, and students had to be given a separate card through which they would be making those transactions and receiving their allowances. But there were constant delays, and when there were delays with the direct pay companies, that meant that students' fees were not being paid on time. And then these...
Plus, it obviously means someone's taking a cut somewhere along the way if you have to issue new cards
The suspended CEO.
Exactly that.
Jesus.
The suspended CEO blames board interference.
You know, there's just so much happening there. And I think even when they eventually suspended him, that did bring into question what exactly was happening at NSFAS. And now there are reports of them paying so much money to these ghost students and NSFAS still coming out and denying that. But at the end of the day, it is the students who are suffering. And even sitting through those parliamentary briefings, there just seemed to be no sort of accountability from NSFAS's side. I mean, Portfolio Committee for Higher Education was asking them some really tough questions, asking them to complete these investigations and come back saying, okay, this and this and this is what we're going to implement to ensure that this does not happen. But then at the next briefing, they're not there. And to me, that just speaks of how...
Well, it makes me think of G4S also arriving for those parliamentary hearings, which you guys report on. And they just don't seem to have answers to any of the questions. No one has actually sat down, including their own legal counsel, and briefed themselves on what the hell to answer here. What is the truth?
But also
there's so much obfuscation.
But also a level of hubris that comes with having political cover. You know, so a lot of the individuals have lots of access to highly placed politicians, and they become the political cover that allows them to get away with not having to answer to anyone, or feel that they can get away with not having to answer to anyone. Also because of who they spend their money on and who they support in the political races.
Well,
all interconnected. Yeah,
I don't expect our guests to comment on that necessarily. Because
like
it does
sound like a conspiracy theory show.
We'll leave the conspiracies to you and we'll investigate.
In the last 3 or 4 years, the conspiracy theorists have been more right than almost anybody else. So we've just got to be careful where we start speculating. So what are you guys looking at now in terms of this Thabo Bester story? Where do you see it going? Because it feels to me like so many things that that end up in the courts, they just get stuck. And there are processes, and there's the Stalingrad approach so often from the people who are either being prosecuted or the people who are doing the prosecution. And I don't know whether people...
And delays.
And people in society just they've given up. Mm. They look at half the stuff that the NPA is doing and they go, I don't even believe you.
And we just saw Coco being... acquitted yesterday, right?
He's not acquitted. The case has been struck off the roll.
Really?
The case has been struck off the roll. Yeah. He has not been acquitted simply because of unreasonable delays on the part of the NPA. Mm. So it's two different things. Coco may want people to think that he's been acquitted, but he has not.
Yeah, sorry, not
but
acquitted,
it does also show that our the major NPA failing at the NPA and Shamila Patoyi. Bringing cases to court.
So with Thabo Bester, I'm worried that the same thing is going to happen. So Stalingrad approach, we saw that with Margot Damana bringing civil cases, you know, trying to get the High Court to say that she was unlawfully
extradited.
Yeah. And just the lack of strategy on her and her lawyer's part, like changing the case halfway through, it's clumsy litigation. And then they struck a nerve and they got something right, which is that the government did mess up in Tanzania. She wasn't supposed to be brought back in the way that she did. They should have extradited her with process. But then the fact that she said before getting on the plane, yes, she wants to go and see her children, is the only thing that makes it legal, according to the High Court.
Mm.
But she says, no, you cannot consent to an unlawful action. So now it's going to be heard in the Supreme Court of Appeal. So we'll see how that turns out, and that might actually turn out in her favor. And then she tried to apply for bail, and that failed, and then she went to the High Court and it failed again.
Because she's a flight risk.
Because she's a flight risk, and that's the bottom line, yeah. But then in terms of the criminal trial, I'm worried. So we had 12 people facing charges. Three charges against three of them have been withdrawn because of lack of evidence. We had a murder charge at one point because of Katlego Boereng. That's been withdrawn because of lack of evidence. My theory is, how it looks so far at this point is that Katlego wasn't murdered specifically for the escape. But the fact that the NPA would even... then bring charge that. Them then with that is worrying. And then you see like
ham-handed stuff.
Yeah. Mm. And you see throughout the court, the kind of initial bail hearings and so on, the police has been giving evidence. And then you see evidence changing. You see numbers of how much so-and-so was bribed changing from hearing to hearing. And that doesn't bode well for the how thorough the police's investigation has been. Mm. And we know that it hasn't. I mean, they only really skrikt wakker when after our reports and then started exhuming the coffins that of the fake bodies that were buried and so on, you know, really doing the basic investigative stuff. Even though they knew by at least July last year that the DNA didn't match, that the body was dead before the fire broke out, and that Margaret Amano was involved.
Well, and this happens, this case for me is also interesting because it's happening in parallel to a case that's been going on for 10 years. This is the Senzo Meiwa case.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Also one where we've been high-profile individuals, lots of very murky dealings. Mm-hmm. Now you've got these charges. Now, at the moment, you know, they're busy talking about a trial within a trial because there's so many things that are shifting and changing. And you focus on the failing of the state in many of these cases. Very similar case, I think, is what's going to happen with this. So 20 years from now, we'll still be having this conversation about whether or not she was supposed to have been extradited, whether Thabo should or should not be in prison, and maybe another escape.
And I think that that's one of the most concerning elements. I mean, in the earlier court cases, the state mentioned something of 30-odd witnesses. And now you're thinking that if cross-examination still needs to take place, if the state still needs to get their affairs in order, and now you've got the defense team poking holes into the state's case that is constantly changing, how long is this trial going to carry on for? Are we going to constantly see charges being dropped and changed every now and then? Are we going to see more individuals who should have been brought to book suddenly seeing that their charges have been dropped due to a lack of evidence? And just how long is this trial going to carry on for? Because even with the Senzo Meiwa case, I honestly was quite shocked because this story started when I was in school. I finished school, went through varsity.
Frightening.
I interned, got, and now years. I'm a functioning adult.
10 years.
And exactly.
Barely functioning adult.
And a very capable investigative journalist in this respect. But I just feel like the public, there's also this weird thing that happens, and maybe you two can comment on this just from an observer point of view. I'm not expecting you here to be a journalist, just to be a human. Society is fascinated by these characters. And I think if Dr. Nandipa got out now, there'd be a bunch of idiots outside court, like, celebrating her. Right? Weird, like, just stupid people who are just entranced by celebrity and wealth and this narrative that she's crafted for herself. They'd be fans of hers. They'd be excited to meet her and they'd want to be around her. There's that element. And then there's the fact that South Africa is a place where there's no accountability for anything. And we're still waiting for Senzo Meiwa's killer to reveal themselves. We're still waiting for someone to come to us with some facts on the AKA murder, which happened not so long ago. We're still waiting for this court case to be resolved, for someone to end up in a prison uniform. And then when they end up in a prison uniform, as this story tells us, nothing happens. Sometimes you just get away.
And I think big headline kind of stories of this nature also then call to mind what is happening to the little guy.
Yeah, I was about to mention.
So when we think even about Katlego and what happened to him and his body, is there are so many. We know this, our prisons are overfull, right? Whether it is awaiting trial prisoners or whether it is people who are actually serving time. But there are so many stories of so many individual failings within the system that people's rights are trampled on.
And how do you think the public is feeling about all of this now? Because you guys have to report it. So you either make it better or worse. What do you say to all of that? It's a lot to respond to.
It's a lot to respond to, yeah.
I think firstly with the element of people being somewhat taken aback and by Margaret Amano. If we look at something as basic as her Instagram following, when we started the story, she was sitting at 124,000 followers. She's now well over 200,000 Instagram followers, and she's since privated her account. But why would you consciously go into your phone and follow someone who is involved with a convicted rapist
and herself
murderer.
Might have been a murderer.
Well, this is the macabre. We like to watch train wrecks, right? There is also something very sinister about the pop culture we live in, which you've touched a nerve with this particular story, in that we like to watch what happens next. We like to see the lives of these people and how they fall apart, essentially, if they fall apart at all.
I mean,
that's why reality TV is so big. Do you think people like Real Housewives?
Can't we write some decent fiction stories rather than have this stuff happen in real life? Do you want to say anything about it, Daniel?
Because fact is stranger than fiction.
Maybe.
Yeah, I think the celebrity culture is one of the most depressing things of this story. Yeah. You know, like the veneration of people who have money and the obsession and the love of wealth and money and greed. And I mean, and that's what they used to lure their scam victims. It's possibly what Bester used to lure Margot Romana in the first place. Mm. And we see that because there's a moral bankruptcy to it.
Yeah.
Because our system, and I think that's what it goes to, is that our system is immoral. You can't get to the top of our system economically, financially, without somewhere
being dishonest,
being corrupt, and that's the thing. And what we see with Thabo Bester is that he exploited that, and people and society's love of celebrity and elegance and opulence, and then he also exploits the court system and the justice system. You know, he slips through the cracks and exploits the weaknesses. Yeah. In order to get ahead. He exploited the fact, for example, that a prison supervisor who's in charge of the whole Broadway segregation unit in the prison earns 15,000 rand a month. Mm. And you promise him 80,000 rand. Yeah. I'm not sure what the number is, but you promise him a few 10,000 rand. Mm. He's going to help you escape.
We cannot close this interview without having a conversation about that glitzy affair in Sandton.
Yeah, let's get into it.
What
do you want to know, Pumi?
Because that event, which was a launch, I think, drew so many high-profile individuals to it. And then that very bizarre moment of it crossing over to New York, which ended up being Thabo Bester's cell. How do you reconcile, so in your investigation, how do you reconcile how all of those individuals were duped into being part of this thing?
Yeah, and that goes to the celebrity culture that we just spoke about. And that, I think that was one of the most fun parts of our investigation.
Yes.
Because that was one of the stories, you know, in those 5-6 weeks from February that we were following up on, because a former employee had sent us pictures of this event. And it actually said that they'd gone to the media back in 2020. And of course, no one knew who Thabo Bester was. No one believed, you know, it just seemed like a crazy story. And when Marisha started publishing those first stories, she sent us an email with these allegations. And that was just bizarre.
Yeah, like I remember when I phoned this person, I was like, well, firstly, thank you for reaching out to us, but please just give me a bit of a background on what exactly is happening here. And she told us that she was a former employee of someone named Tom Mutsipe, and that back in 2018, there was this woman in media scam, which I remembered because I used to live on the streets of Twitter. So I remembered that the woman in media conference was the biggest scam from that time. And she said that had the journalists extended themselves a bit further, they would have realized that Tom Mutsipe was actually Thabo Bester. And she told me that she had pictures and videos of this chairman's dinner event where all of these high-profile celebrities and distinguished politicians, people in the media industry were invited to, and that Bester had actually video conferenced from New York, but he was actually in prison. listening to that on the phone, I thought there's absolutely no way until I saw the pictures and the video.
Because some of the people who were billed to be coming to this event were actual, like, Hollywood A-listers who then went to Twitter to say, this is fake. I am not coming to South Africa. I remember that kind of coming out and thinking, this is crazy. And I saw the invites. I don't get on those lists, unfortunately. Thank God. I don't like to leave my house.
And they were selling tickets for like 2,500.
They were selling tickets.
And that's what that goes again to the celebrity culture. And how many people in South Africa can afford to pay 2,500 rand to go to an event? 0.2% of our population, right?
Yeah. Mm.
So it exploits that segment of our population who want this glamour, who are addicted to this glamour and eloquence.
You'd think
and
that
celebrity.
The people who had any money wouldn't be stupid enough to throw it down a hole like this, but clearly they're also very, very stupid people falling for nonsense.
Yeah.
Guys, good luck with the book. I think it's going to be a terrific bestseller in this country, mostly because you're covering so many interesting things in here.
Now, the
quite
movie
apart
rights.
From the actual story. Yeah, the movie, Netflix special on the way and all that kind of stuff. I think you're lining yourselves up as consultants for that no matter what. So what a pleasure to have you both here, and thank you for coming to see us this morning. I'm sorry about the power delays and all the rest of it, but we got it on the go. Marisha Damons and Daniel Steyn, thank you so much for being on the show. And the book is called The Tabo Bester Story. You don't want to miss it. The Rapist, The Celebrity Doctor, and The Escape from Cell 35. What a story. Thank you, Pums.
Intense.
We'll see you tomorrow at 6 a.m. Cheers, everybody. Bye-bye. CliffCentral.com.